Hello and welcome. I'm author and broadcaster Dan Jones, and as part of my duties as historical consultant on Nightfall, I've been locked in a dungeon to record the official podcast. They say if I feature lots of extra info and behind-the-scenes testimony straight from those who worked on the show, they might feed me. Well, we'll see about that. I'm going to keep saying it. I'm going to say this every time, so get used to it. This show contains spoilers, so please catch up with the fourth episode before you listen to this. The fourth episode. There will be spoilers up to and including the fourth episode. Okay, here we go. In this podcast episode, we're going to be talking about the Holy Grail. That's right, we only tackle the small issues on this podcast. To help us get our heads around how this small cup is sending everyone in Nightfall hog wild, I've got all three of our leading Templars on the phone. That's Tom Cullen, Simon Merrills, and Porrig Delaney, backed up with showrunner Dominic Minghella. And if they can't get to the bottom of what it's all about, then I guess it's time to pack up and go home. But first, let's remind ourselves about what just happened in episode 4. And where should we start? Well, how about at the very beginning? That's where Landry is heading as he takes a trip into the woods, both literally and metaphorically. See what I did there? Good. When he goes round to his mate Jonas's house and ends up out of his tree on medieval hallucinogens. Now, to be fair, Tancred warned him this might happen before he went.
Jonas, he's a pagan. He walks in darkness.
But he didn't listen, did he? And sure enough, he ends up having a nightmare about a Cathar who's gone seriously off message, abandoning the gentle heretical doctrine of there being a couple of divine beings in contention, and devoting his life instead to running round scaring children with a bear claw on his hand, a bear claw being something like a Gruffalo slipper crossed with a chainsaw. Is there historical precedent for all this? I'm going to get back to you on that one. Now, what we do know is that when Jonas is through with Landry, he wakes up speaking in tongues and burbling about the Brotherhood of Light, who are either a prog rock band or a shadowy organisation with a special interest in the Grail. I think the message here is don't do drugs, kids. Not even if the guy with dreadlocks who's pushing them promises you'll unlock the secrets of your childhood and the location of the most holy relic in Christendom. Meanwhile, back at the temple... Poor old Pierre has taken on the role of Gawain's whipping boy. And when I say whipping boy, I really do mean... Yeah. But of course, there's good reason for all this. A Saracen has died in the temple, and Landry has left instructions for his mates to get to the bottom of it. What I'm thinking he didn't expect was that his mates would be at the bottom of it.
Brother Tancred, you stand charged with murder.
Nasty. But probably not as nasty as what's going on over at the palace, where Queen Joan's extended family have come to stay.
Your Grace.
Queen Elena of Catalonia is causing trouble. She's been dropped a hint by de Nogare that Luis and Isabella might have been jumping ahead with their marriage preparations. She forces Philip and Joan to put Isabella through a virginity test. More of that later.
Don't make me do the courage.
That's extremely horrid. But not as horrid as what happens to poor old Sebastian, Isabella's horse, the hands of the beastly English,
to send him back
to the palace, Don Corleone style.
Sebastian!
What does that mean?
It means war.
Oh, right. That's what it means. Now, in this episode, I want to focus on the Holy Grail, because after all, that's what everyone has been chasing around, as if the entire history of Christendom depends on it. Now, the Grail often divides people on the Templars, because let's be clear, if we're talking about real facts, then there is and was no such thing as the Holy Grail. And I mean that absolutely. I don't care whether you're thinking about a cup that may or may not have been on Jesus' sideboard, or a metaphor for the ancient secrets of the church. The Grail was no more a real thing in the real temple than Spectre in the Bond films is a real problem for modern-day MI6 or CIA. But it doesn't follow from that that the Grail is irrelevant, because actually, even though it wasn't a real thing, its legend is as old as the Templars themselves, and so are the associations with the Templars. The Grail, or Graal, first appears in the legends of Parsifal and the court of King Arthur, which came into being around the mid-12th century, originally by the French romantic writer Chrétien de Troyes. Now, in 1200 to 1210, that's the start of the 13th century, when the Templars were at the peak of their powers, the German adapter of those Parsifal stories, a guy called Wolfram von Eschenbach, had the Grail or Graal guarded by a group of knights called the Templesen. In his stories, these Templesen had doves on their uniform and not crosses, but it's pretty clear who they were supposed to be. Templars, guarding the Holy Grail. So what's the point here? I suppose that although, as I've said, the Holy Grail comes from mythology and legend, its associations with the Templars are centuries old. They weren't invented by Indiana Jones or the Da Vinci Code, and certainly not by Nightfall. So what we're doing in the show is retelling ancient stories. I think we're following a long line of storytelling that stretches back more than 800 years. And to my mind, that's just as important as the history itself. Anyway, that's my take. But what about someone who really knows what they're talking about?
Hello.
Dominic, it's Dan.
I called showrunner Dominic Minghella and asked for his take on the Holy Grail and its place in the Nightfall world.
The search for the quest for the Holy Grail is about, quite easily resolved down to a question of, what our lives are about, what are we for, and what do we chase after, and what are we really expecting that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow really to deliver for us? What kind of answers is it really going to give? And this particular journey, this particular season one journey of our knights is really kind of simple and universal. It's what's life about? What's life about? And, we have to make choices to go one way or another. And our character, Landry, makes a big sacrifice to go after the Grail. And there's, query whether it's worth it. And, the things that seem so important to us because everybody agrees they're so important, and there's nothing, by definition, the Holy Grail is the most important thing in the world ever. And even that is subject to scrutiny and question and doubt. And so it's, what are we here for? What are we about? It's an existential inquiry. Certainly season one is.
Dominic Minghella there taking us through not only the basic story to Nightfall, but how the Grail is there to really drive that story on. Now, all that got me wondering how our knights felt about the blending of Templar history and Grail legend. So I started by asking Simon Merrills.
You're making a historical show, so there is a construct there. There are some real figures and broad sweep of events are drawn from history, but of course we're making a drama. So, for instance, our three characters, Tancred, Landry, and Gawain, are constructs. They're fictional knights. The hunt for the Grail, that's the very sweeping and romantic addition to our story, and it's one that many people are familiar with as a theme.
The Grail is so closely intertwined in the mythology that surrounds the Knights Templar that it's sometimes hard to separate the fact from the fiction. And another of our three main knights, Porrig Delaney, who plays Gawain, confirmed that when we spoke about what he knew about the Templars before joining the show.
I suppose, like everyone else, kind of limited knowledge about who they were. What I knew was probably tied up in the mythology of the Templars and Freemasons and all of that business. But no, to be honest, I didn't know the intricate details about the Knights Templar until I picked up a book. Unfortunately, yours wasn't out at the time, so I had Malcolm Barber's. Which was great. It's not as accessible as yours. I'm not blowing your trumpet here, but it's stranger than fiction, isn't it?
Of course, the Grail has particularly special significance to Gawain, all stemming from one heroic action at Acre 15 years previously.
In episode one, we start to see how Gawain's injury is affecting him in his kind of day-to-day duties, basic things. He struggles to get up on a horse, but he's in denial. That's the thing as well. Gawain is constantly in denial about the situation, refuses help from his fellow brothers. And it culminates, I think it's in episode 2, where Gawain has found out he can no longer hold his own in battle. And not only that, but he puts, you know, Landry and Tancred in danger as well. So then when Landry, who's recently been appointed, you know, the master of the temple, tells him that he can no longer be a warrior, he takes it quite badly. And from that point on, his relationship with Landry is never the same. Never quite really trusts him again. But still, he takes it. And around about the same time, of course, Denogre starts whispering in Gawain's ear that, you know, listen, if the Templars don't appreciate you, I can introduce you to people who will appreciate you. And not only that, he also puts the possibility in Gawain's mind that they can heal it, not through, you know, praying or anything like that, but, you know, they've got doctors in the French court who can look after Gawain. So that seed is planted, and you see that happening in, you know, quite early on in the series.
Now, everyone knows about the Grail's fabled healing properties, and we see evidence of that from Godfrey's brother, who we met in episode 3. But one thing Nightfall is always careful to do is to remain grounded in the real world. So we never see miracles manifested in front of our eyes. We just have to take people's word for it. And that faith is what supernatural objects like the Grail rely on. From that, I want to dive into a conversation I had with leading man Tom Cullen.
Now, we're seeing all of those guys together, both for the first time and then later in Paris, searching for something that draws from Templar legend more than from Templar history, but that is there at the heart of the Templar story, and that's the Grail. And I wonder if, just from your perspective, you can tell us, like, what does the Grail mean? What does it represent? Is it just a cup? Is it a sort of magic, like medieval Cocodamol or whatever, you know, that can heal all wounds? Or is there something bigger? Just tell me what the Grail sort of means to you.
It's a metaphor. It represents different things to different people. Yeah, it's a difficult one to answer because it bridges a gap between myth and legend.
I think it's interesting because, you know, historically, when we look at when the idea of the Grail was created, you know, 1190, at the sort of midpoint of Templar history, we start to see the idea of the Grail being fed into Templar stories. And it's exactly what you've said there. It's a metaphor. It represents Jerusalem lost and Jerusalem there to be regained. And I think, you know, one of the most powerful things about the Grail over the years, one of the reasons it's endured, you know, 800 years, is that you can invest so much in it, right? Like, Landry can see one thing in it, the Pope can see another, the King of France can see another, but they all are competing for their sort of vision of what it means.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for saying what I was trying to say. that's exactly it. I think that it's very true in human nature. And in politics, and it will be always ever present that we will use anything to move the masses, and we use symbols in order to further our own political agendas. And that's what the Grail operates as. It's a symbol in which you can turn people to your aid, to your gain.
So that's the Grail. But before we go, I want to come back to one more completely non-Grail-related topic from episode 4 that I think a lot of people will have really picked up on in this episode of the series, and that's Princess Isabella's virginity test. For me, it's a really powerful part of the episode in which the stark vulnerability of the women in Nightfall is really exposed. No matter how much agency they seem to have, what we're learning from both Isabella and her mother Joan's journey is that in the Middle Ages, I suppose like in every age, a lot of the basics of the power dynamics between men and women rest on the unarguable facts of human biology. And that was something I remember the writers really wrestling with for this episode. They actually did a ton of research into midwifery, obstetrics and gynecology in the Middle Ages as they worked towards building that scene. And I remember pointing them towards, among other things, one of the most famous medical handbooks of the period, known after its author as the Trotula. So while I was watching this episode, I went back to that book to see what it had to say about virginity, and found actually it had some pretty ingenious things to say about cooking up remedies that would allow a woman to fake virginity. The first involved making a potion of ground sugar, the white of an egg, and alum, mixed with rainwater, pennyroyal, and calamint. The second involved leeches, and actually that's all I'm going to say about it here. Anyway, obviously, from episode 4, we can see that Isabella has been reading her Trotula, and good for her. Actually, one more thing before I go that I really wanted to mention, and this also comes up in episode 4, is the orange. Now, we saw an orange appear in the first episode of the show quite mysteriously, placed up on a wall, catching first Godfrey and then Landry's eye as they saw it. And here, back in episode 4, da-dun-da-dun-da-da, it's the orange again. We don't have time in this episode, but I really, really want to come back to this in a future episode of the podcast. What is the orange? We're going to ask someone. Now, I also really want to hear from you. And this week's open question from a listener comes from Trina, who wants to know where all the locations in Nightfall come from. It's visually fabulous, says Trina. Well, thank you very much. I can't take a lot of credit for that, but I'll pass the praise on. The answer, Trina, is that other than the first scene of episode 1, which was shot in Dubrovnik, Croatia, almost all of the show was shot in Czechia, formerly known as the Czech Republic. Lots of it in Barrandov Studios in Prague, and the rest round and about that exquisitely beautiful country. If you have a question for us, search for Nightfall or History on Facebook and Twitter, or tweet using the hashtag Nightfall, and I'll do my best to address them here. Now, that brings us to a close, but what's coming up next? Well, next time, we'll be speaking to a few familiar names, but also to Lords Faberis, who appears as a new character in episode 5, and who might be my favourite character of the entire show. Thanks for listening. History's Nightfall podcast is presented by Dan Jones and produced by Sam Pearson for A&E Networks.